The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't see...
We still, to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Dr. Yusuf Elgin-Gehi is a GP at Bromley by Bow Health Center and the author of How to Dismantle the NHS in 10 Easy Steps, which came out from Zero Books in July of last year. He's a guest this week, and we discuss how the NHS is being broken up into a private insurance system based on the American model. It's Thursday, May 5th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. Here in the States, life took an absurd turn in the last few days as the reality television star Donald Trump locked in the Republican nomination for the presidential campaign. What's important to understand about Trump is that he is a winner. He's all about winning and not about losing. He's also going to make America great again. And Trump steaks are the world's greatest steaks, the best tasting steaks. They're 5-star gourmet steaks and are certified Angus Beef Prime. In this episode, you'll hear Martin Freeman throwing his support behind the junior doctors and the NHS. And you'll hear a perfectly objective description of the TTIP, produced by the IBT Partners. IBT Partners is a website localization and online marketing business with the passion, knowledge, and skills that make the difference. They're ready to support your in-marketing. They're ready to support your in-market representation. And Trump steaks are the best tasting steaks that really belong in the most elite 5-star restaurants. Right now you're listening to The OJs, For the Love of Money, as covered by Nectar, a song you might have heard before if you've ever watched Donald Trump on The Apprentice. But in just a moment, you'll be hearing Yusuf Elgin-Gehi and I discuss how to dismantle the NHS. Dr. Yusuf Elgin-Gehi is a general practitioner in East London. He studied medicine, neuroscience, and English literature at Oxford University and completed his clinical studies at Guy's, King's, and St. Thomas's in London. He has been working in the NHS since 2006, and he is the author of the book, out from Zero Books, How to Dismantle the NHS in 10 Easy Steps. So, Yusuf, welcome to the Zero Squared podcast.
Thanks, Doug. Hi.
One of the things I want to ask you off the top is about your studies at Oxford. You studied English literature and medicine. I'm not sure how common or uncommon that is, but were you torn between medicine and literature or maybe writing when you were a younger person?
I think I've always kind of had a foot in both camps, as it were. I think medicine perhaps lends itself quite well to that because it's not as just a science, really. It's more of a bridge between the arts and the sciences, between the what C.P. Snow described as the two cultures. So it's quite useful in that way. And in fact, some people describe medicine as really a social science and as something that's actually very political. So in that sense, it wasn't always entirely alien to then jump briefly and do a detour in English literature for a year. There is a historical tradition of medics who've been writers as well. So wasn't the first.
Your answer is very, very interesting, especially when you say that medicine isn't necessarily a pure science, but it's something more like a social science. I don't think I've ever heard that before. Of course, I haven't studied medicine. Right. Is that a common view amongst doctors?
I'm not sure it's a common view, but certainly amongst, I think, public health academics or sociologists, it would be. I'm thinking particularly of, I think it was Virchow, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who said that medicine was social science or politics in practice, and that it was nothing else. And I think when you particularly look at medical sociology, then you come across the fact that health is directly correlated to socioeconomic status. So it is very political in that sense, although you're right, we're not accustomed to conceiving of it in that way.
Right. So it's a social science in so much as you have to make political decisions about what kind of treatments to develop and who receives those treatments.
Yeah, that's one aspect. But it's also the fact that, for example, people's life expectancy, their likelihood of getting long-term conditions, likelihood of obesity, of smoking, drug and alcohol dependence, all of that is linked to your socioeconomic status. So as a general rule, the more deprived you are, the more likely you are to experience those things, so to have a shorter life expectancy and to develop long-term conditions earlier. And that's very much linked to, it's interesting because where I work as a GP is the Bromley by Bow Centre in Tower Hamlets. Tower Hamlets is a very deprived area overall. But that model of general practice there is very much based on something called the social determinants of health, which is that principle that health is linked to socioeconomic status. That it's not just about doctors giving you magic potions. It's actually about looking at the holistic picture, that people's employment, their housing, socioeconomic status, all of this informs their health hugely.
Does that mean that a large part of a doctor's role is to be a champion for the poor then, if they're trying to extend, say, the life expectancy of the underclass? Does that why you might be so involved in just defending something like the NHS?
Yeah, absolutely, Doug. I think that a doctor is always an advocate for their patients, whoever they are. Absolutely, I think you should be championing a healthcare system which is a great leveler, really. It's an equalizer. It means that with something like the NHS, that it's that people are looked after based on their needs rather than their ability to pay. So that's something that provides a great deal of equity and fairness, really, in terms of the provision of healthcare for a nation. So absolutely, to see that being dismantled and privatized is very sad.
Yeah. So in your book, you say that the NHS is not only under threat, but that it has already been effectively abolished.
Yeah. So it's that's kind of the headline. It's been abolished in legislative terms. So we had this whopper, this doorstopper of Parliament legislation. Basically, a piece of legislation that was passed through the British Parliament and is now effectively law, which is called the Health and Social Care Act 2012. And that has essentially done a number of things. It's all kind of quite abstract legalese, so it doesn't make for the most interesting reading. But I think if any of our listeners have insomnia, then they should probably have a look at that piece of legislation, because it's a fantastic soporific. But to try and sum it up in a lively way, it essentially axes severs the government's responsibility for the National Health Service. So that's part of privatization, of course, is denationalization, and it devolves that responsibility to a number of other bodies. And it also opens up the NHS to privatization, so to really unlimited outsourcing and to private companies taking over contracts. It's not something that wasn't happening before, but it has now been ramped up and accelerated.
Now, what is the justification for the Health and Social Care Act? Its advocates, what were they
suggesting that this bill or this legislation would address, and why was this put forward as a some sort of remedy or reform?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So it's not certainly not something that just dropped out of nowhere. This has been a gradual process of taking what is for those listeners, particularly on your side of the pond, they may not really understand what the NHS is. So it was created just after World War II, mm-hmm. And this was obviously in the wake of a global catastrophe, which had left tens of millions of people dead. And in Europe, particularly, there was a great sense of a need to create a more fair, democratic, just and peaceful society. And in Britain, although Churchill had been the Prime Minister and he was of a kind of coalition war government and he was a Conservative, it was actually the Labour Party under Clement Attlee which won the election in 1945 in a landslide, surprisingly. But that's because they were quite responsive to the needs of the British public at the time in the wake of the end of the war. And their manifesto promised a welfare state with a national health service that would be tax-funded and free at the point of delivery, along with all kinds of other aspects of the welfare state, such as public housing, benefits to help people, for example, if they were unemployed, and pensions. And so that's the kind of origins of the National Health Service, or NHS. And it's gradually evolved over the years. But really, the story I'm concerned with begins in the 1980s, so under Margaret Thatcher, who was a Conservative Prime Minister. And that's been a 30-year journey taking us up to the present, which what we're dealing with, as I'm sure you're well aware, is neoliberal economics. So kind of an economic school that I'm sure people will be familiar with in America, is it? It's very, very active there, isn't it? And it originates from the Chicago School of Economics, doesn't it? And so the proponents really of that kind of economics have advocated reforms in every sector. So this isn't just about healthcare, but it's essentially complex to distill in a few words, but it's about privatization, deregulation, deunionization, shrinking the public sector. And that's what's been applied to the NHS as a 30-year plan to essentially convert it from a publicly run, publicly funded and owned healthcare system into a market-based healthcare system.
Now, obviously, they're not coming forward and saying, okay, the aim is to privatize healthcare and the NHS. We want we have a neoliberal agenda. Here's our legislation based on that. So they're going to come forward and say there's a problem. This is a solution. We need to reform the NHS because as good as it is, it's broken. So I mean, what was the opposition's justification?
Yes, yeah, I think I answered a question you hadn't asked yet. to answer your question, yeah, absolutely. No, of course, this is never presented in that way because that would be electoral suicide. The NHS is here considered to be sacred and one of the most precious national institutions. So no, it's always being presented in with smoke and mirrors and in a very clever way with the use of euphemisms and misleading language. So for example, there'll be the use of such terms as modernization, reform, and the idea of liberating the NHS, which is, of course, an economic term in the sense of really liberalization, so opening it up to investors. So that's what's been very cleverly done and over such a long period of time that it's insidious and it's so gradual that the public doesn't really notice what's happening. The way they've sold this, as it were, to the public over the years has been in a number of ways. So that clever use of language to kind of cloak the real intentions is one way. But there's also been quite a bit of propaganda and arguments that have been proposed that are essentially not based on evidence, which state, for example, that public healthcare system, and I think you'll be familiar with this over in the States as well, weren't you, in terms of what the Republicans often propose. But the idea that the NHS isn't affordable, it's not sustainable. And those same arguments are, of course, applied to the welfare state. And I think I'm sure you're accustomed to hearing it in the US, aren't you, in terms of we can't afford these benefits or
In the US, the policy that I think gets a similar treatment to the NHS in the UK is Social Security. So we've been hearing for years and years and years, decades, that Social Security isn't sustainable, that it's going to be going away tomorrow, that it needs to be reformed. You know, there's always this fear every election cycle that if the Republicans get power or if the wrong Democrat gets power, it's just they're going to rob Social Security and just privatize it, put it into the stock market, take the money and run. How is the NHS funded and is it protected in a similar way that Social Security is protected in the United States?
The NHS is still, as it has been from day one, what you call a single payer funded system. So it's funded through tax.
Right.
So through the taxpayer. But what's gradually happened over those 30 years is that it is being kind of eaten from the inside, as it were. So it's gradually being marketized from the inside, and more of it is being sliced off and bitten off in chunks for private companies and investors. So through, for example, public-private partnerships, through outsourcing, and now with this whopper piece of legislation, through the opening up of contracts for frontline services to private companies. So it's being done in lots of clever ways, but it's on the surface, going back to kind of this idea of how they are getting away with it, as it were. On the surface, things still look very similar to the old NHS. And this is what confuses a lot of people, is that they still go to their doctor and receive care that's free at the point of delivery. So they don't really understand when we talk about privatization what's happening. But this is a very, as I'm sure we'll kind of go on to cover, it's a process which not right now, but which will potentially in the future, and perhaps not that far away, lead to an insurance system not too dissimilar to the one that you have in the States.
Now, when you say like the one we have in the States, you mean the new one, Obamacare? Mm. Or do you mean just the kind of even worse situation that we had, you know, 8 years ago, Obamacare kind of the model that the UK is looking at right now?
Yeah, I mean, very good question. Again, obviously health economics and how you design health systems is complex. And as you've pointed out, it's not something that's static. So in the same way that things have changed here rapidly, certainly they're changing rapidly in the States. But if anything, it's interesting that you guys are going perhaps, you know, converging almost away from the fully privatized insurance system, because it just wasn't adequately providing for the healthcare of millions of people. So, I mean, certainly, I have to say I'm not an expert on
Obamacare.
On Obamacare or the US healthcare system. I mean, my understanding is that Obamacare is a small step in the right direction, but it's certainly something that was unfortunately hugely diluted on its way as the legislation was passed.
The way we look at it on the left here, I think, is that it's a public subsidy for private insurance companies, and that while it does it lowers the bar for and provides some assistance to impoverished people to help them get health care and does ensure that everyone, regardless of a precondition, can get health care, it still isn't the ultimate system or the best system, because it relies on private insurance companies and it makes it it's still extremely expensive. We have one of the most expensive healthcare systems in the world. And, you know, I always championed universal healthcare, actual, you know, like the NHS, socialized medicine. So I would certainly think that if you are living in the UK and have the NHS, going to something like Obamacare would be a step backwards. And even for people in the United States, many felt that Obamacare was a sidestep away from actual universal health care. While it did help many people, it was still structured so that the private insurance companies would maintain a stranglehold on healthcare.
I mean, that's a fantastic distillation of it, really. I think I can't phrase it much better than a public subsidy for private insurance companies, which is certainly the format that a lot of policies take these days. But of course, yeah, I mean, Obamacare was diluted by, it was opposed, of course, by vested interests by those powerful private healthcare and particularly insurance companies. And as you say, I guess the way in the end it was passed was that essentially the way I think it was sold to the insurance companies, the only reason they accepted it is that it meant it would be they would get more money in that it would be extended to cover those 30, 40 million Americans who aren't insured.
Right. So the NHS, you're saying that that private insurance companies are now taking on some of the responsibilities in the UK. That there's tell me a little bit more about what the Health and Social Care Act actually did. Not to go into the boring detail, but
no, the important stuff. So essentially, that we've covered a couple of the points, which is that it has denationalized the health service. Mm. So that's step one. Step two is it has reduced the legal obligations of the NHS to provide comprehensive care, so to provide the patients and public with a comprehensive health service. The legislation cleverly begins to around the edges undermine that fundamental principle. So certainly in future you may see that the development of essentially insurance pools in which certain types of patients, often the poorest or sickest, may actually be excluded because they tend to be the most expensive and the most risky, as it were, as we all know from how insurance companies think. The third thing it does is it opens up the NHS to unlimited takeover of contracts by private companies, and quite a lot of them actually are American companies. So United Health is probably the company that you would presumably know about that is making inroads here. So that's things that the Health Act does. But actually, that was a few years ago. And since then, last year, the Conservative government, so kind of the equivalent of the Republicans, as it were, won a majority, actually, which was unexpected. And but could have been predicted, I guess, really kind of retrospectively, I think you can see how it actually was predictable that they did win. But they're now kind of very aggressively pushing forward plans to accelerate this process of privatization, because from the outset, they haven't been, the Tories have never wanted the NHS to exist. So now we're seeing a 5-year plan for the NHS, which is actually very explicit in terms of talking. If you actually look at this document called the 5-year forward view, which was produced by the NHS chief executive, Simon Stevens, and we should come back to him. But in that document, it explicitly talks about modelling the NHS on US style insurance pools, which are called accountable care organizations.
But it didn't used to be the case that, even now, Cameron isn't able to come right out and say, I don't like the NHS and I'd like to get rid of it, right? No. The NHS is the most popular public institution in the UK at the moment still.
Yeah, I mean, these ratings fluctuate, but yeah, you're absolutely right. It is generally extremely popular, and particularly that principle of, if you look at the kind of breakdown of the polling, the principle of care-free at the point of delivery, that is, you know, hugely overwhelmingly popular. In terms of other ratings on the NHS, certainly at the time that the Health Act was introduced a few years ago, those ratings were at record highs. So there was no justification in terms of public satisfaction. But of course, as deliberate policies have been undertaken, such as stealth cuts to the health budget and other policies which are kind of generating a manufactured crisis, then you see obviously the ratings go down slightly. Mm-hmm. But absolutely, you're right. Overall, it's extremely popular.
Yeah. So what is it that's changed in the general outlook that's allowed I guess both the New Labour politicians and the Tories to make inroads, you know, as they have through something like the Health and Social Care Act. I'm struck by something you said at the very beginning of your book, which is that Margaret Thatcher felt that her greatest achievement was the construction of New Labour, that she had somehow, I guess, shifted the political ground in the UK. So I guess what I'm asking in a roundabout way is, how is it that such a popular program is vulnerable, and what's the ideology that makes it vulnerable?
It's very interesting, isn't it? How can something be so popular and yet politicians are trying to dismantle it? Well, essentially you're looking at, if we're looking kind of at the history of neoliberal economics since the late 70s, what I guess you've seen is a hijacking of democratic processes, mm-hmm. Through a number of mechanisms. So those include lobbying, so corporate lobbying, funding of political parties and elections, the revolving door. So to name a few, those are the ways in which political processes have been hijacked, really, in the interests of the corporate elite and against the needs of ordinary people. And that's particularly been applied in the NHS, but in every sector. So, for example, taking the NHS, the government department responsible for it, the top levels of NHS management. With all of that, you see those processes in action. So you see how health ministers, health secretaries, top health managers go off to work for lucrative jobs in private healthcare or as advisors to those companies. So that's particularly one mechanism by which policymaking is controlled, as it were, and you end up with something like the Health Act.
As somebody who has been in and out of hospital a few times in my life and has had family members rely very heavily on the NHS and the fantastic treatment that we receive there, I'd like to throw my weight behind the Junior Doctors campaign for better conditions, wages, hours. You have my absolute support, which is why I say support our junior doctors and keep our NHS safe. Thank you.
Well, you have in your book, you have 10 different steps that have already been accomplished to dismantle the NHS. And one of them is that you run a PR smear campaign. And you often get asked, you say that you often get asked, where will the money come from? And that there's been a big kind of concocted scare campaign around the NHS not being sustainable. As I mentioned earlier, we have something similar about Social Security every couple of years. Is there any truth to the idea that the NHS might be difficult to sustain economically, that whether because of the economic crisis or a fiscal crisis, that the NHS is at actual risk?
This is absolutely fundamental. It's right at the heart of the whole issue. So the idea of what you've described very nicely as socialized medicine, of a public healthcare system, that's actually, if you speak to health economists or public health academics, that is actually the most cost-effective way of running a healthcare system. And that's why the NHS budget is about 7-8% of our economy, of our GDP. Now you compare that to market-based systems, so to the kind of mixed European models, such as you see in France, Germany, Holland, and they're spending about 10-12% of their GDP. And if you then compare it to your model, to the US insurance kind of fully privatized model, that's off the chart, really, about 18%. Now that really is unaffordable in a sense. So that's the irony there. And that's interesting because it flies right in the face of the neoliberal mantras that we often have shoved down our throats, which is that if you bring in markets, if you bring in the private sector, it's actually cheaper, it increases efficiency, it improves performance, and so on. Actually, our experience of the NHS being converted into a market system and that of other countries demonstrates all of that clearly to not be true.
In the United States, it seems that it's always a little unclear as to whether or not the expenses, even as a portion of the GDP, can really be chalked up exclusively to, say, the privatization of insurance, or whether or not the fact that you have a larger population with maybe different cultural habits might be a part of the problem. You know, like you have to look at how many smokers are there in the United States as compared to the UK, or, you know, what's the level of obesity in the United States as compared to the UK, both of which probably were doing very badly in comparison to the UK. So I wonder if it's true that the way that we pay for insurance is the ultimate determinant of its expense, but also My question would be this: even if there are worse ways to fund or pay for insurance, even if you can make healthcare more expensive, it doesn't really answer the question as to whether or not the NHS is under threat fiscally. You know, if the UK economy is actually having trouble maintaining the NHS, it could be a smaller percentage of the GDP, but it could still be a problem.
Sure. No, I mean you're definitely probing me. I think in terms of is all the extra cost when you compare our healthcare system, so the NHS, with France, well, with European models or with the US model, is that extra cost all attributable to markets or privatization? No, it's not. You're right. There are other factors. But in terms of you know, for example, the things you mentioned, such as smoking, such as obesity, actually having a universal healthcare system means that you can target those public health risks in a much more effective way than you would in a system where basically people fall through the holes and they're left without insurance and without the provision of a good standard of healthcare. So, for example, I think in the US, I understand that primary care, or what we call GPs, general practice, isn't necessarily well designed all over the country. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So I think obviously there's pockets where it is better than other places, but generally, that, for example, here having a relatively good general practice or primary care system means that you actually try and prevent, you know, have health prevention strategies applied to most of the population. So there's that factor. I think certainly there's quite a huge amount of evidence that looking across the world, that introducing market forces in healthcare does inflate costs. And if you look at the US system, for example, that kind of fee system puts the incentives, lines up the incentives really in the wrong way. So the fact that physicians, laboratories, pharmaceuticals, companies, well, healthcare companies, insurance companies, all of those are paid for their services means that it actually encourages all kinds of things, really. So it encourages unnecessary investigations, unnecessary tests, treatments. You also see, interestingly, with companies like United Health and others such as HCA, so that's, I think, Hospital Corporation of America, isn't it? You've actually seen a track record of extensive healthcare fraud, which where they've had to pay back, as I've documented, you know, myself, and others have, of course, where they've had to pay back millions in fines to various branches of the US government or to shareholders. So there is a big inflation of costs that comes from the application of market forces. And that's because you've got to remember that a market also introduces all kinds of mechanisms. So contrary to it being lean and efficient, you actually get things like auditing, billing, contracting, You get payment tariffs, all kinds of mechanisms which inflate costs and have to be, of course, dealt with by whole layers of bureaucracy and of administrative and managerial staff. So that's another reason why it inflates costs. And the other thing is, of course, that once you bring in private companies into a public service like healthcare, those companies actually only have one legal obligation, which is to make profits for their shareholders. And so they have to pay out dividends and make profits. And again, that encourages the inflation of costs.
To what extent is the financial crisis that we went through in 2007 and 2008 behind this resurgence of a push to privatize the NHS? And to what extent do you think this is a long-term ideological goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we've seen across Europe, haven't we, and I'm less familiar with exactly the details of what's happening in the US, but what we've seen across Europe really is a program of austerity since the financial crisis. And this idea, of course, that what was a banking crash being presented as actually a public spending crisis, which is a complete inversion of reality. But that's, of course, how you sell it and how you then justify massive public spending cuts and austerity. So what we've seen is, in fact, that although the crisis was, the 2008 crisis was caused by actually at its heart, the neoliberal economics, and it should have really been almost a kind of the fall of the Berlin Wall moment for neoliberalism. It's actually what we've seen is the opposite. And we're seeing now kind of turbocharged neoliberalism max, in which you're seeing more privatization, you're seeing more shrinkage of the public sector, and you're seeing certainly more siphoning of wealth to the top. So I think that is, yeah, I mean, that's very linked to what is happening, in the sense that the diktats, I think, for this austerity program are coming from the financial sector, from the City of London in the case of the UK. And it's part of a long-term ideological project to reshape really the nature of the state, so that it is more privatized, more financialized, as an economy, more deregulated, deunionized, with a smaller public sector. And of course, the reason for that is that the NHS budget is over £100 billion annually, which in dollars would be even more. And that's being essentially prized open, that oyster, for global capital, because, of course, that's what neoliberalism is directly linked to, is a globalized economy.
What happens when the world's two largest economies get together in a single free trade and investment region? This is what the EU and the US are doing, and they call it the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP. Together, they represent over 50% of the global GDP and over 600 million of the richest consumers. The positive implications for the two economies are huge. And guess what? Preparations are well underway. Currently, there are many so-called regulatory issues, as well as the tariffs that act as barriers and set the EU and US quite apart, making transatlantic trade and investment much harder in each other's regions. But what are these regulatory barriers? For example, if an automobile manufacturer makes a new model in the US, it needs to make sure it meets European standards when exporting to the EU. Or think of an X-ray machine. The European company fabricating it may need to spend tens of thousands of dollars in compliance costs to meet U.S. requirements when selling its healthcare products in the U.S. That's why TTIP has been launched. Its aim is to secure a groundbreaking free trade and investment agreement between the U.S. and the EU, both of which produced $16 trillion worth of goods and services in 2012. So what are these talks about? Briefly, about two things: regulations and tariffs, which will then drive market access. First, about regulations.
Regulations are laws that protect people from risks to their health, safety, environment, and financial security. The EU and the US will try to make their regulations more compatible while keeping people protecting people before existing regulations. This could mean that when US regulations and EU regulations have the same effect, like prescribing the safe level of food additives or proofing medicines, they can be recognized even if their content or the authorization process is different. The regulations can also be brought closer to each other by changing or updating.
Sure. So the TTIP is the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is an EU-US trade agreement. It hasn't been passed yet. It's kind of undergoing a process of negotiation. I think recently the brakes have been put on it. So I think there's been resistance to it. Certainly Obama is very keen to push it through, but there's been quite a bit of resistance from senators, hasn't there, in the US. And there's concerns about the effect it could have on jobs and so on. And here in the EU, I think there's been, and I imagine the same in the US, there's been a lot of concern from activists about what TTIP could do. So essentially the way it's being presented by politicians and, well, governments and the mainstream media is that it would essentially remove trade barriers between the EU and US, and it would help economic growth and boost jobs and so on. In fact, there's very few trade barriers left. So when you actually look at what TTIP would do, it would actually it would promote trade liberalization, so opening up of particularly public services to private investors. And one of the things it would also do is to actually lock in privatization of public services, thus making it irreversible. And one of the ways it would do that is this clause called ISDS, or Investor State Dispute Settlements. And if you look at other trade agreements which have been passed, such as NAFTA, you see that the application of those investor state clause has been applied. What it means is that essentially, if government at any level takes steps that could harm the profits or even the expectation of future profits, which is a remarkable thing, of a corporation, then that corporation could actually potentially be able to sue the government. And it would do so not in the normal law courts, but in a private kind of justice tribunal, which would be behind closed doors. So essentially it would act as what trade agreements like this do is that they essentially benefit corporations, and they act as a deterrent for governments to carry out policies that could harm the interests of corporations. So they're quite remarkable things. And that's why there's been a huge amount of resistance from campaign groups and activists, because with something like the NHS, for example, it could then, if it's opened up and privatized, that could be made almost irreversible in a sense.
Yeah. So you've been involved in much of the activism to protect the NHS in recent years. So since your book's come out, I know that it's been popular with various activist organizations. How would you say that your book has been received overall?
I'm very, very happy. I'm trying to do my bit, as it were. I've been writing articles for various national media outlets such as The Guardian and The Independent, and it's even been covered really by unusual allies. So, for example, the London Evening Standard, which is the kind of biggest daily that's circulated in London, covered it very nicely in a kind of double page spread. So that's normally quite a right wing newspaper. But the interesting thing about something like the NHS is that it actually is very unifying. So you know, plenty of ordinary people, you know, even affluent and middle class voters and even conservative voters consider the NHS to be sacred. So it's something that's very precious. And so to, you know, when you come out and write a book or articles, which talking about what we've been talking about, then people are, of course, very alarmed. Yeah, certainly now trying to set up kind of a roadshow of events across the country. So hopefully we will get that message out there.
Your book is so, so pessimistic. Or it starts from a premise which would seem profoundly pessimistic, which is that you're looking back on how the NHS was already dismantled and letting people know, who may not even be aware of how much trouble the NHS is in, how what's gone on. So my question is, how is your book delivering an upbeat or a hopeful message to activists? How can we take this information about all the ways that, say, the Tories and others have tried to undermine the NHS and do something to protect it or to reinvigorate or to reinstitute that program?
Yeah, you're right. It's I think the initial reaction when you've kind of been on the receiving end of all this information is actually one of feeling overwhelmed and demoralized, which is understandable. But I'm an optimist. And I don't think there's much point in doing any of this stuff if ultimately you're going to give up. So I think there's remarkable stuff that has happened in recent months. And the amazing thing is how quickly everything moves. So even in the 6 months since the book, well, actually, no, it's been a bit more, hasn't it? But in the last few months since the book came out, you know, when you're thinking about kind of doing an updated edition at some point in the future, there's already so much to cover that would come in, have to come in kind of an 11th step or something. But for example, you know, the junior doctor, there's been a huge junior doctor movement here, which just seemed, you know, completely took us all by surprise, really. And that was over a kind of dispute over a new contract with the government. But that looks like it's, you know, going to blossom hopefully into something even bigger. And, you know, back at the end of last year, there were, you know, 20, over 20,000 doctors or so on the streets of London and other cities. So the fight to kind of save the NHS is taking off in all kinds of remarkable ways. One of the other key aspects is really legislation. I mean, you need legislation to effectively reinstate it, to restore a public NHS. And that's one of the things that really confuses people, is that they don't understand when they look at the problems, some of the problems the NHS does experience now, they can't see that what's happening behind the logo, as it were, that a lot of the problems the NHS experiences, not all of them, but some of them, are certainly down to the use down to privatization. So, for example, the fact that hospitals are struggling is very much down to something called PFI debts. So the fact that the hospitals during the New Labour years were built by private investors, and they're having to pay absurd astronomical levels of debt off. And that's running services into the ground. But of course, people can't see those things. What we need is to take the NHS back to a publicly run and funded and owned healthcare system. And there's a piece of legislation written by some very bright public health academics, one of whom is Professor Alison Pollock and her colleague, a barrister by the name of Peter Roderick. And that's called the NHS Reinstatement Bill, which I mention at the end of the book. And that's something that has really taken off since the book came out, and it's been in front of Parliament, and it's something that we will continue to push because it would really solve a lot of the problems that I mentioned in the book.
One last question. Can I ask you a personal question?
Yeah, of course. Yep.
I understand you've had your own health issues lately. And so how are you? How's your health? How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Doug. You're absolutely right. So again, that's something else that's happened since the book came out, which was a massive shock. I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is a rare blood cancer that tends to affect younger people, actually. But that literally happened overnight, that I just woke up one morning and whilst shaving noticed a lump, which turned out to be a lymph gland. And after that, I was obviously diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I've had several months of treatment in the form of chemotherapy and radiotherapy, and hopefully out the other side now, but just waiting for the all clear still. So it just has reinforced really the fact that I've experienced being on the other side as a doctor, experiencing it as a patient has been a massive eye opener, and has only kind of underlined and reinforced my desire to fight for universal healthcare, because you never know when your health is going to be affected. It is really the most precious thing all of us have at the end of the day. And the thought that, you know, if this had happened and I was living, I didn't have the NHS and I was relying on private insurance and might end up paying thousands of pounds for what should really be a universal right is something that is very alarming and that we have to fight over here to preserve.
Yeah, and it sounds like you had this detected early, that because you were a doctor, you saw the lump and immediately got it tested, and also because you had access to even now good healthcare and free healthcare in the UK, that I can imagine someone like myself discovering a lump like that and letting it go for months. Going, oh, it'll go away, or
I mean, I think, to be honest, I'm not sure being a doctor had much to do with it. I think although sometimes it might do, but I think in this case it was most people I think would have presented to their doctor. But you're right, I think in the US, of course, if you're one of those millions of people who didn't have insurance, then you would absolutely delay going to see a doctor because of the costs, and or you might not even have access to good doctors. So you're absolutely right. It's fundamentally important for people, to have access to good healthcare. But we know actually from health economics that once you introduce things like charging and insurance, that it becomes a huge deterrent for people. So you end up with later presentations and worse outcomes.